Coming up, I'm going on background with someone I've worked with my entire career in politics. Someone that has worked in as many, if not more, campaigns than I have, but from an entirely different perspective. He's not a conservative, he's not a liberal, not a New Democrat, not a Green Party operative or a bloc member or part of the People's Party. He's a journalist, he's a reporter, someone whose career has intersected with mine way too many times, someone who's a storyteller like me, but from the press side of things. I work in campaign war rooms, he works in press rooms. Now, it's time to go on background. Today, I'm going on background with Glenn McGregor, formerly of Ottawa Citizen, Post Media, and CTV, and now a freelancer with iPolitics, and one of the top investigative journalists in Ottawa. He was the main reporter who covered the infamous In-N-Out scandal of the Conservative Party that followed the 06 election, and if I may say, the fictional robocall scandal that came out of the 2011 campaign. He may not agree with me on any of what I just said, but let's go on background anyway. Glenn, I'm excited and a bit nervous to have you on today.
Nice to see you again, Fred, under different circumstances. We meet again, rivals.
But yes. Now we're in the back room together.
That's right. That's right. And I'm not calling you up accusing you or your party of doing nefarious things. So this is a nice change.
Yes, it's a much more pleasant experience, I think, or at least I hope. Let's see how this goes. So, Glenn, I think it's an interesting contrast, you and I, where I've been in war rooms, you've been in the press room.
Right.
So I think it'll be interesting to go and explore that. A war room, I don't know. Have you ever been in a war room?
Yeah, a couple of times during campaigns in the 90s. I think somebody snuck me into, I think, the Liberal war room.
Really? During a campaign?
I was supposed to meet somebody. You know, the war rooms are always interfacing with journalists during campaigns, right? They want to talk to them a lot. And that, you know, they're because
that's
their
primary job, responsibility.
Yeah, they're trying to spin. Message, right? And, yeah. You know, with me, because of the kind of journalism I did, they would often come to me saying, hey, we have a tip. Here's something we found that we think you might find interesting, right, and want to pursue. So, I mean, not just war rooms. Because, I mean, war rooms, I think, we think of as being campaign vehicles, which, of course, they are. Everybody sets up their own war room. But they really are kind of an extension of party research offices, right?
Yes.
During that are outside the writ periods.
Yeah.
And I've, throughout my career, tried to get to know people who work in opposition research or government research, usually opposition research, because their role is kind of allied with journalists, right? So
their job is to feed you, right?
Well,
their job
but
their job.
That's part of their job. But also, they are, not to be too high-minded about it, but holding the government to account. So if you right now in the Conservative Research Office, you are digging up stuff on government, and so are journalists. Journalists are primarily holding the government to account, also to a lesser extent holding the opposition to account. People complain we don't do that enough, especially right now. So there's a lot of crossover. So I got to know guys, like going back to the Reform Party Alliance days, I used to know a lot of the researchers in the Reform Research Office, guys like Laurie Thronis, Patrick McIntyre. I don't know if you remember these guys.
I do.
You know, they were really good. Mm-hmm. And they're like me. They're research dorks.
Right.
Like they totally get into digging up, you know, expense records and pulling property records and things I love to do. So we have a natural kind of crossover there. And then I also, you know, during the Harper era, I got to know people in the Liberal Research Office because, again, there was kind of symbiotic relationship there to a certain extent. So I got to know Kevin Bosch, who now runs a Sandstone, a big consulting company. He's a really smart guy, great researcher.
Yep.
Chris Swale was a guy who was in there, now works at Ottawa City Hall. So, yeah, you kind of get to know them. But, you know, it wasn't, you know, obviously not appearing regularly in war rooms. But I think they are, they seem a little, you've been in a lot of newsrooms, so they must seem to you a bit like newsrooms too, right?
Very similar. You've got a big open space with lots of TVs around it so you can see what's going on in the world. And then you have a whack of hardworking people all in desks, all lining up.
Right.
And reacting, either pushing, in a campaign war room specifically, you're designed to either push stories or defend stories.
Mm-hmm.
So it's both. So it's obviously giving you stuff to attack the Liberals on, like stuff that we've dug up that we think is the public should know about. But at the same time, also defending the incoming attacks.
Yeah, of course.
Which is a big part
of it. And to be clear, I mean, when journalists talk to people in war rooms, and someone's going to listen to this and take this totally the wrong way, that we're just being spoon-fed stuff by whichever party, that we treat them as tips. And whether it's from a war room or a research office, you know, this is a lead that someone gives you because it's in their interest for you to get that story in the paper or on television, but you have to check it out like you would any other tip. I think, though, the party, the war rooms and the research offices are kind of great sources because they connect to kind of the grassroots of the party in the sense that someone's in, you know, a riding in Manitoba or Saskatchewan, hears something, passes it up, and it ultimately ends up in the research with a researcher who works for the party who decides, hey, is this something we can verify? Mm-hmm. And is it good for us? And can we give it to a journalist who's going to run with it?
Right.
So that's why I think those are great. So I always tell, you know, new journalists who are coming to Parliament Hill, I said, like, you know, don't worry about your relationship with members of Parliament so much. Go talk to staff. Talk to the researchers. They're the ones who are going to help your career.
Right. They're the ones who are pushing the stories.
Exactly.
And whatnot. So you had a story this week that was interesting where you you dove into the Prime Minister's travel.
Right.
Or sorry, his time off.
Time off.
Now, you did this on your own, I assume. It wasn't...
Yeah.
It was one of those things where you just saw something and you...
Yeah, I mean, I've been curious about this. You know, Pierre Poilievre likes to hammer the Prime Minister all the time for his vacations. We've heard about him going to Tofino or going to Whistler or to places in the Caribbean. And I was kind of curious about how much time he actually did take off.
Right.
So this Prime Minister, unlike other Prime Ministers, and he should be lauded for this, he actually puts on virtually every day, this few days he misses, but he puts out a public itinerary of what he's doing that day. And 680, whatever the number was, I can't remember from the story, saying it was 680, over the 8 years, those itineraries listed him as being on personal time,
mm-hmm.
right? I don't think anybody would begrudge the Prime Minister for taking personal time, and I thought it was an interesting number. I compared it to the average working Canadian who gets weekends off and, you know, an X number of vacation days, and found out he was working more. He had less personal time than those people.
Right.
But, you know, he's not driving rivets at General Motors or working the cash register at the Circle K, right? Like, he's a leader of a G7 economy, mm-hmm. and we expect him to be working a lot of weekends. People can argue about whether they think that quantum of time that he took off was legitimate or whether it was reasonable or if it was excessive. I'm not an opinion columnist. I'm not an editorialist. I don't have an opinion on that. I just kind of reported it.
It's interesting, just on this front, I'm hearing from a lot of liberals I talk to is they feel the media is very much against them right now. Because you see
right
all
now,
the headlines.
Yeah.
They're terrible, right? The headlines, the economic statement yesterday that came out or earlier this week that came out was very, a lot of negative headlines. But to me, it feels like the liberals aren't feeding journalists either at the same time, right? Mm-hmm. They're not pushing back on stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed, like, there's a lack of narrative from the government. And obviously, like, people, I hear from liberals, I do a lot of panels, a lot of media, and liberals are telling me, you know, why is the media so much against us? Why aren't they doing their job holding Poilievre to account? I'm like, it's a liberal's job as research bureau, their research bureau, to dig this
stuff up.
And the
comm stuff, too,
right?
Yeah,
and maybe they're holding for the election, which is, you know, that's obviously, you have to make that decision.
They need to be digging stuff up on Poilievre, or do they just need to be kind of counterpunching against the things he says and does?
Either one is I mean, I'm sure their research bureau has lots of stuff that, given he's been an MP for 20 years, right? He's been in the public the public sphere. There's lots, I'm sure, in their view, to go at him on. But in terms of counterpunching, they're not even doing that, really. Like, every few weeks we see a little thing, and it's a video or something. There doesn't seem to be a strategy there to punch back. And I just find it interesting, because when I was
liberals
were always punching us in the face.
Sure. I don't really know. Well, I mean, first of all, in terms of the press coverage, I think, I mean, the press gallery is a herd animal.
Yes.
And it tends to
move
as a pack, right? So when it turns on somebody, everybody goes at once.
And it almost feels like, when you're watching this all the time, it feels like, what's even the point of showing up to work if you're the Liberals? Well, you still have to govern for 2 years.
Well, that's
actually the government right now, and you have work to do.
Yeah.
So it is a weird
And I think that a lot of journalists kind of have these, like, sort of rubrics of how to cover a government at a certain point. And the rubric they're applying right now is the walk in the snow metaphor, which everybody loves to do because it shows how clever you are, that you know your recent political history about his father. So they repeat that line over again. And there's columnists who have written that story about Trudeau going for a walk in the snow for, I don't know, 6 years now. They do regular.
2 weeks ago, he went for a walk in the snow in Quebec. It was snowing somewhere. He was saying he's going to run again.
Yeah.
And that got coverage in Quebec. So it's,
I mean, people ask me to think, you know, is he going to leave? I don't know. I have no clue. I don't, I mean, having talk to people around him, and spoken to him, not like particularly recently, but you know, on trips abroad, PM trips abroad that I've gone on. And my sense was that he absolutely wants to stay. And the other thing is, I mean, if the opposition and people who don't like Justin Trudeau want him to leave so badly, you can say, well, why is that? I think there's two reasons. First of all, they don't want him governing anymore. And that's a fair reason.
Sorry, you think the opposition wants him to step down as prime minister?
Well, they keep calling on him to do it.
Yeah, but
do they really, right? I mean, if they really think he's such a reduced entity, a weakened force politically, that surely to God you'd love to run against him in the next election campaign.
Yes.
Rather than having... Well, I mean, it's not going to be Mark Carney. Everybody likes to fantasize about that, but I don't think he's going to do it. But rather than have somebody else fresh come in to run against you, I can't imagine. I mean, I think the reason they know he's a good campaigner. Like, he's come from behind. I think in the last three elections,
he's three for three
coming from behind. So, he theoretically could do it again. And the thing about him, I mean, I don't know if you've spent, like, you've met him, right?
I have been in the same room with him before he was prime minister, but I've never met him.
He's really good. Like in the room, as you say. Like,
right.
I mean, he's not a very good speaker, I don't think. He was a professional speaker, and I don't think he was very good at it. He's gotten better at it, but his real strength is like you come into a Knights of Columbus or church basement for a rally, and like there's maybe 100 people there, and people get so engaged by him
right.
and so excited. I remember the first time I'd met him on the Hill a few times when he was an MP, but nothing formally. My first interview with him was during his leadership campaign back in 2012. It's in St. Catharines, Ontario, massive blizzard. He's doing some event, campaign event that night, leadership campaign event. And then I say, I'll meet in the restaurant in this Holiday Inn. Somehow the staff at the Holiday Inn who are working in the restaurant get word that he's coming in.
Right.
And I'm like, do they even know who he is? Like, I mean, he wasn't like a huge name. They were at Twitter about this. They were so excited. And then he comes in and he like, you know, shakes hands, makes eye contact with them, engages with them. And people just like, that's his real strength as a politician, is that one-on-one stuff.
Right.
It's not standing in front of a room giving a big speech.
Right, right. So we talked about outside of an election, running a war room, or a press room and doing your thing. What's the shift during the election? You've been on lots of campaign planes over the years. Like, how many elections
I've been on? Actually, no. I mean, what I've, throughout my print journalism career, I mostly covered campaigns from Ottawa.
Okay.
Because I just thought that was
And you're
easier.
An investigative journalist more
yeah,
so, right?
And
so
I would always get like roped into writing a daily campaign notebook, just taking little things. So I talk to our reporters who are out on each campaign, saying, do you have little tidbits you can feed into this like three-dot column or boldface name column? And we'll just figure out, you know, what's going on.
Right.
I did go on the last two elections, so 2019 and 2021, on the campaigns. And they were, as I thought they would be, essentially mobile hostage takings, right? Like, you were just...
Explain that.
Well,
so I've never been on the... It's funny, I've been in, like, not lots of...
You've run campaigns, but you haven't been on one.
I've never been on the road.
Oh, really? I didn't
for
know
a campaign, and I refuse to. It's not my thing. I don't need... I'll be a distraction if I'm there.
So, like, you show up at the Avitat, which is, like, the private airport, the first day to get on the campaign. And, you know, the exception to this was the campaign you ran last time.
Pandemic campaign?
The pandemic campaign. And we'll talk about that because I got some issues about that. But I'll say typically what happens is, you're set on the Liberal campaign or the Conservative campaign or the New Democrat. So you show up at the private airport and you get on a chartered plane. And it's lovely because, like, there's hardly any security. You're not putting your bags through. You're not lining up with people. And you get on there, and they've got your seat assigned. And then your news organization has made a deal with the campaign that they're going to pay them a certain amount to have you aboard, and they're going to feed you and wine you occasionally, too, and cover your travel. So everything, like, it's easy travel. But it's very hectic because you have like multiple stops every day. You're getting on and off the
plane.
And
it changes, right? Like, so I have been a part of changing tour. So as campaign manager, you would see where things are and you would make
change during even the course during the day. You would change, But it's exciting because you're seeing parts of the country you've never, like, I've never been to Calumet, right? Until I've been on an election campaign.
Right.
Been twice. I've never been to St. John's, Newfoundland. Boom. Went there a bunch of times with, I think, Scheer and Trudeau. So, and they're exciting. I mean, you know, especially in the first week when people are really jazzed.
When it comes to campaigns, the first week and the last week is where everyone pays attention. The middle is that drag that no one does.
For journalists, too. And they're starting to rebel against their captors.
Right. the people were, even though we're feeding you and giving you lots of booze.
No. Then it's like you get the reverse Stockholm syndrome. Like, it's like, you know, how can we escape or how can we, you know, make life miserable? But, and I think, you know, journalists are contrary people by nature. So, that you know, they are aware that you don't. But, you know what, it is a thing. And this is kind of a larger theme above and beyond just campaigns. Is journalists tend to like people that they deal with in political parties because they're usually smart people. They, by definition, have very similar interests, right? And then you hang out with them. And so you go on campaign, you end up in the hotel bar and chat about what happened that day. And I mean, it's a real danger that you become friends with the people you cover. And you have to kind of guard against it because, you know, when you have to go down and write a story, I do a story about Fred DeLorean and, you know, what a jerk he is, right, that might become awkward between us. So you have to kind of always
Fortunately, that's never stopped you, so that's great.
Well, you always have to keep that kind of the back of your mind.
Yeah.
That, yes, you can like the people and find them personable and enjoy the professional relationship, but they're not your friends. And that's a tough balancing act, I think, not just during campaigns, but, you know, everybody ends up at the same parties in Ottawa on Parliament Hill,
right?
You're going to the Cafe Metropolitan, and, you know, three times a week, and you end up with the same people talking to the same folks, and you'll end up liking them, right? Because, you know, and sometimes that's good because you can develop sources that way, but you also have to maintain that balance of saying this is where our professional life ends and our friendship begins.
So a campaign day, you guys, you get up, you're obviously work, you know, you're with Ottawa Citizen, Post Media, and CTV, different outlets at different times of your career. And when you're on the road with CTV, so you have a call with CTV producers in the morning to kind of figure out where you're going, or are you just going out there?
A lot of that is just done like by email.
Yeah.
Now. I think in that court, sometimes you have a call, you check in with your desk and say, what are we doing? And what do we think the story is going to be today? I mean, you know this well, is that the campaigns like to frame each day as kind of a discrete story and arrange events that are going to enforce that narrative. So you have a policy and your message of the day, right? So what your policy announcement, let's say our policy announcement today is on housing affordability. So what would the event be on the campaign?
Right. So you'd go out and have, you'd have the leader in front of a house.
Right. And then reporters know what the message is going to be. Maybe you're told the night before, this is what we're doing, here's where we're going. So you try and, so you tell your desk or your editors, this is what they're doing today. And then you have the conversation, okay, do we want to do that story? Or is that, you know, do we wrap this up into one election campaign story with three other reports filing into it? And nope, this is their message of the day. Or is it something different? Are you knocking them off their message? And that, as you know, that happens on campaign too, right?
Usually
in the middle of the campaign, right?
We call it a $1 million mistake when you go off message that day, because 36 days is a campaign. It's roughly a $36 million cap.
I never heard that before.
So if you lose a day, if your message, everything you're putting into that day, and that's the message you want to win, whatever your issue is, if a bad story comes out and knocks you off, you've just lost $1 million.
Like a candidate who pees in the coffee cup.
Yes. Yes. Lots of.
That suddenly becomes
a stupid $1 million mistake because it wasn't, that candidate wasn't vetted properly, right?
Right.
So that gets through. From the campaign side, we do try to script many days in advance. Usually it's 3 days. For the 21 campaign, we were really able to plan ahead. We had a week and a half to 2 weeks of scripting done. And if you recall the 21 campaign, Aaron O'Toole came out of the gate firing on all cylinders.
Well, right? Came into the hotel room firing on all cylinders.
Through
the
gate and into the hotel room.
This is where I have, you're asking about what's your day like getting on the planes and flying all over the country. So in 2021, the first week I'm assigned to cover the Conservative campaign, I think, great, that's going to be fun. We'll see, new candidate. We're going to see a lot of the country. Where are we going to go? And then we spent most of our time in the first week at the Westin Hotel in Ottawa because you guys had built this big soundstage. And I'm sitting there in the food court waiting for the press conference at the Rideau Centre going, Fred DeLorey, man, what are you doing to me here?
I'm so sorry.
I thought I was going to be traveling all over. Yeah. And it was going to be exciting. And here I am hanging around a hotel
and
waiting
every day
for a press conference.
For the first 14 days of the campaign, we got our message out clean. And it was working for us, right?
See, I don't think it was, okay? And I'll tell you why. You know, I was working in television at the time, and what I need are fresh pictures every day of the candidate doing something visually different. And I understand your rationale for running the campaign out of the soundstage or whatever you called it.
During a pandemic.
During the pandemic. Like, we were absolutely in the
parts of the country were coming in and out of lockdown.
And people were people were campaigning with masks on. Like it was not to take away from that.
And for our ability to map out our messaging, we had to figure out how we're gonna do it. But yeah, I see the point on the visuals that could have been done.
Yeah, because every night the visual we had was him walking out from behind the set.
Right.
Speaking and then walking out. And it could have been the same visual. You know, he changed his tie and jacket. But that's right. It's exactly the same thing, right? Whereas, you know, those message of the day things, hammer nails in a building site or going to a brewery or whatever it is you're doing, small business, flipping pancakes, like, you know, those things are great in television.
Right.
Because it engages people more. Less important for print, for sure, because it's more issues driven and we don't care about the visuals as much in print, but mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, that was a challenging campaign, right? Just to map out the whole thing where it was like, you know, different parts of the country had very different rules too.
Yeah.
On what you could do, what kind of, we made you guys test every day too, right?
That's right. We had, all the campaigns did. Well, I bounced and forth between the Liberal campaign and the Conservatives. So I don't know what they did on the NDP campaign, but yeah, both those campaigns gave us test kits and they'd give us like a week's supply.
Yeah.
And then what you'd have to do in the morning when you get up is stick the swab up your nose and then do the test. And then you had to take a picture with your phone and send it to the guy who's running the buses, the campaign buses, every morning, proof of life photos, right?
Yeah.
And I actually got into it because what I started doing was holding up my campaign or my COVID test strip in front of the window. So I had at least a different backdrop every day. So I had this great like photo archive of all of these.
Funny time, eh?
Yeah,
it's a different world.
Yeah, it was a strange time. I should block all that out now. I've forgotten all.
Yeah, no, a lot of people do, and maybe for good reason.
Yeah,
but yeah, it was a difficult campaign for that on that front, and we had to do it in the war room. We had to do testing everyone that came in. We had to go through that. So you have a reputation in Ottawa as one of the best investigative journalists, where you dig in, you storytell is how I look at it, where you don't just, you know. A lot of people do great work. They put a story out, and then they're on to the next thing. You dig into certain stories and stay on them for a long time. Uh-huh. And there's two where I was on the opposite end of as a communicator for the party, and I'd love to kind of go in and out of these stories, if possible, if you will. And first one, the In-N-Out scandal.
So to speak.
And so the In-N-Out scandal started in the 06 campaign.
Yeah.
That was the one national campaign I wasn't on. I was actually in a local campaign. Then I was in the Prime Minister's office for a bit after we formed government. Then I went to the party and became the Director of Communications. And then I started dealing with this issue with you. But just to set that, if you can go into it.
Sure. Let me set the stage. So I'm working in Center Block on Parliament Hill as a reporter. And I work in something called the Hot Room, which is kind of like a bullpen of bunch of desks of and it was where traditionally the press gallery, as we call it, they all worked out of there. The press gallery has grown in size, so the Globe and Mail, all the net broadcasters, they all have their own offices now. But it used to be everybody worked there. And there's still some journalists there, mostly freelancers and people who string for anybody. But I liked working out of there because I felt it was close to the House of Commons physically. Right. And I liked it. And another guy who worked there was a freelancer named Tim Nometz, really good reporter who just retired not that long ago. And he and I were kind of working on the same thing. We were going through, this would have been like well after the campaign had ended. So we're into 2006, like summer, fall, I think. And we're going through the returns that each candidate has filed. And he and I independently noticed the same thing, these weird wire transfers that the candidates, the conservative candidates, have all made in and out of their bank accounts. And so we start working on this together. And what we find out is that what the Conservative Party did in that election campaign, 2005 to 2006, is that they, as you know, there's a very strict spending cap on the amount of money a national campaign can spend on broadcast advertising, right? And what somebody smart person at the Conservative Party figured out was that we can use the spending headroom in local candidates' campaigns. At that point, I think there was 308 of them. Mm-hmm. To pay for at broadcast advertising. So we're going to transfer them this money. They're going to pay for the broadcast ads national broadcast ads.
That they would pay for, out of their campaign to their region where they were, right?
It was
into their region, maybe not their riding.
Not their riding, but in the area.
Which would be, like, if I was to be a candidate in Quebec City, I would run ads on Quebec City radio. It would hit other ridings.
Yeah. And then they would the money would be transferred back within days back to the party immediately. Right. And it was a scandal that only an accountant could love because it was really hard to explain it.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately what it came down to was the conservatives in that election campaign were able to spend about $1 million more on broadcast advertising nationally than they were legally allowed to. And I think it made a difference. That was a closely fought election campaign. It was the first election the conservatives win with Stephen Harper. And it works, right? And they ended up, I mean, you and I had some interface over this, I think, when party officials reached an agreement with Elections Canada. They were going to plead guilty to it in court, pay a laughably small fine of $50,000, and then it was done, right? And it went away. So...
But this is several, you skipped
this
over
is over a couple of years.
And lots of stories on it, right?
Lots of stories because we were following the bouncing ball. And the thing was...
There's also the fight on the GST rebate, right, that we were fighting that would have lowered the cap of the party.
Right, and there was also the thing about candidates get back, if they get a certain percentage of the vote in the ridings, they get a refund of their expenses to a certain... Mm-hmm. What were they going to get refunded? And then they got into this whole... Went to federal court, and it was one of the dullest federal court cases I've ever... I mean, they're usually boring, but this one was agony.
So did you and Tim first discover this and break this before Elections Canada? So Elections
Elections Canada, we learned that Elections Canada was looking into it as well. They knew. Their auditors had caught it, but they hadn't flagged it publicly. Tim and I independently figured this out and started writing stories about it. And then we go to Elections Canada for comment, and they talk about how they're in this. They're basically going, I mean, they audit this stuff pretty closely, and they go back and forth. And this begins a pretty acrimonious relationship between the Harper Conservatives and Elections Canada, right?
Yes.
Which becomes an issue, as we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
And it was, there was a lot, Mark Mehron.
They raided our offices, right? They raided
That's right, on the office. In and out thing. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. I remember getting a call. I was at my chiropractor in the Glebe. I remember getting this call saying, oh, yeah, the RCMP is here at Conservative. You were down on Albert Street at that point.
Albert Street, yeah. I remember, so years of dealing with this as the director of communications when I went in there after dealing with you and the GST case. And I was there. So the raid was before I was at the party.
Okay.
So
that was like 2008, I think. Maybe.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think I went in at 2009 at the party. I mentioned the story actually recently talking to Alex Kohut. It was February, I think, of 2011. I get a call. I think it was from one of the lawyers or someone within the organization saying, hey, four of our people are going to be charged, including the fund. Come up with a plan to deal with this. So I was like, oh, okay. So I called Dimitri Sudas, who was director of communications to the prime minister at the time, after hours, of course, when it dealt with party stuff during the day. So I called Dimitri and I say, so here's the deal. What the heck do we do with this? And Dimitri, without even a second, he just comes up with a full plan. He's like, all right, you're going to call these 10 outlets. You're going to wait until after 6 or 7 p.m.
It was in the evening. I remember because I got one of those calls.
Yeah,
was it from? I can't remember if it was from
It was from me. You were out of the country.
You're right. You have a great memory. I was in North Carolina on a workshop course in Raleigh.
Right.
And I was out in a bar and I was like, Fred DeLore, what? Oh, my God. Yeah. Really? You're being charged?
Yeah. Right. So I gave, so Dimitri told me, he said, do it this way. Here's the 10 outlets, English Canada, French Canada. Divide it up, and you're going to give the story. It's going to be but only under certain conditions.
Yeah.
You have to agree not to name me. You have to agree to don't post it until 10 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to agree that you don't go to another source. I'm the lone source.
Okay.
On the first run. Tomorrow you want to do another story. Got that. So Dimitri had, I was like, okay. So we executed that plan. And at 10 p.m. that night, almost every major outlet had the exact same story.
Right.
And it muted it so well, effectively. Like, there's four senior people in a party being charged with breaking the Elections Act. I thought it was a brilliant plan that Dimitri came up with, and we were able to just... And I was very impressed just like that.
So you can spend reporters for a day, but then they're going to go do their own thing.
But still, that story was really muted after that.
I think the story was muted in large part, too, because it was so difficult to explain. I remember, like, sitting down to write... updates on that story as Tim and I were doing our reporting. And, like, it was so convoluted having to explain the spending caps, the transfers in and, right? And, You know, I think it was a really important story. It was just, it was so hard to John Iveson was then running for the National Post.
Yeah.
He referred to it as a bicycle crash, right? That is to say, a British expression meaning, you know, it was an incident, but no one got badly hurt and it was of little consequence.
Right.
And I disagreed fundamentally with that because I thought, if you can spend that much more money on advertising during campaign, you've got your finger on this. Like, that's a huge advantage. And I thought the fine the party ended up paying was laughably small. And that was the maximum fine under the legislation they could charge, which had never anticipated anything like this happening. Right. So they got away with it. And I always wondered if that kind of set, I mean, first of all, it set the Conservatives kind of in opposition to Elections Canada and Mark.
We took shots at them, right?
Yes.
We put out statements attacking
Elections. Do you remember Pierre Poilievre in that period getting up? He was then, was he parliamentary secretary of the PMI or was he House Leader? He would get up and go, he'd lead the back benches in this chant, in, out, mocking the whole thing, trying to draw parallels to other similar transactions that have been made, right?
Right.
And he was effective at it, you know. And you're right; it didn't have a large consequence.
Well, it didn't. So this was February. I said we got charged. The party got charged, and those four individuals. 3 months later, we won a national majority government.
That's right.
Our first and only majority government since '88.
Right.
So it had
nobody was talking about internet.
No, and that's what to me going back, looking back at that February, you get this major story.
Yeah.
Just a few months later. It means nothing, and we win a massive election.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you guys in the comms shop effectively quashed that, and I think it was, you know, probably easier to quash because a lot of journalists just didn't understand it. It was hard to explain. Didn't work on television. Terrible TV story.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, but, yeah, that's kind of the nature of the beast, and some stories are like that. They're important but boring.
Yeah. Well, speaking of beast, let's talk robocalls.
All right. So contrasting to In-N-Out was robocalls, right?
Yep.
So basically what happens on election day, May 2nd, 2011, this is the election that you guys win your majority, thousands of people in Guelph, Ontario start getting these automated calls saying that their polling station had moved, gone somewhere else. And Elections Canada doesn't send people, doesn't use robocalls, and they don't use robocalls to tell people their polling station was moved. It was a prank. Somebody had, or a prank or a, you know, a trick. And Elections Canada catches on to it that day. Within days, has investigators on the ground talking to people who got these calls. So they start this investigation. But the thing that was fundamentally different with robocalls compared to In-N-Out was that it was an incredibly juicy narrative, a story, right? And it unfolded kind of as Steve Marr, who was my reporting partner in this, got more documents, and we'd get, you know, court records that showed the course of the Elections Canada investigation, trying to track down who was responsible, because they didn't know at the beginning. Like, they had no idea. I remember Steve and I were in the press gallery one day in the hot room, and we get this fax sent to us from the court in Edmonton. It's a document called an ITO, an information to obtain that an investigator has to swear out to get a search warrant, which the Elections Canada investigator did. And he has to say everything he knows about the case to that point to satisfy the Justice of the Peace who's going to issue the search warrant. So we get this thing faxed to us, and we see this name, Pierre Poutine.
Right.
And it's the first time we've heard this. And it's like, oh my God.
Now,
this
story,
be more
you guys
perfect?
Have already started on this story?
We've already started. We know Elections Canada is investigating because we spoke to people in Guelph. And the calls were reported in the media at the time.
Right, because social media was new then. I remember hearing some buzz on Twitter, I think. Like, it was muted. It wasn't like social media is not what it is now.
Right.
But yeah, there was this weird buzz with it.
Yeah, and I mean, CBC, a guy named Dave Seglins had done some initial reporting on it down there, but we didn't know if it was going anywhere. And then Steve and I found out that this was this active investigation, and that's where we get involved. And then we find out that Elections Canada sent an investigator to Alberta to track down the robocalls company, this service called Rack9 in Edmonton that is used to make the calls. And then he's going through this like incredibly detailed paper chase of trying to track where the calls came from. And it brings up things like burner phones, that whoever was doing it, the Pierre Poutine villain, used a burner phone. So it's kind of like The Wire, right? Like it's really, it's exciting. And people get so into it. And it was easy to understand, unlike In-N-Out, which is all this accountancy and rules. People could understand, oh, they've called you up, had a machine call you up to tell you your polling station moved. Well, that's really unethical. That's really dirty tricks,
that's
right?
That's awful.
So people got into the story, and it became a national story, and Steve and I were fortunate to win all these awards. We got to go to dinner at the Governor General's house. It was great. But at the end of the day, it was, you know, In-N-Out was really important. Robocalls, it was an attempt by probably a bunch of college kids in one riding. And it didn't work. The liberal candidate in that riding still won.
It was a stupid idea.
Yeah.
All it did was, again, destroyed their careers.
Yeah.
And, but it did leave a blemish on the party. It did.
And
cause this, like,
arguably
we're talking
something.
About
to what extent do you think that had changed the outcome of the next election?
I think it may well have affected the outcome. It changed the game. It occupied us for years dealing with this issue because this was one riding, Guelph. But there was these copycat stories around the country popping up, right? I was a lone communicator as director of communications for the party, no staff.
Right.
And political operations was always a big unit in the party throughout our entire minority years. We win the majority in 11, so we shrink the office down and save money, which made perfect sense at the time. But now we have no staff. We're a skeleton crew.
So it's you or it's, the one
it's
man.
Me. It's me.
Manning
I'm
the desk.
By myself dealing with every small town paper in the country reporting, some person thought they received a call too.
Right.
And this was all over the place. There was these copycat stories. And there was what was the organization that brought the party to court with seven or so ridings?
Council of Canadians?
Yes, Council of Canadians.
Yeah.
Thank you. That they did a poll and said, oh, we found these ridings. And that was a $1 million expense from the party having to defend.
Sure.
I'm pulling that number out of the air. I don't actually know what it costs. But we had to defend all these MPs now who are being challenged with their elections, which was complete nonsense. There was nothing. I know Elections Canada did a very fulsome actual investigation into all of this as well and found that there was nothing here. I met with Elections Canada to sit down because I was on the campaign in 11 and they found like Guelph is the only thing that was the one spot, but I do think it impacted us. I think there was some issues, and then we had the Saskatchewan robocall issue,
right, which you and I were on opposite sides,
very opposite sides where I
do you want to recap I barely remember this, but
I'm
do
glad
remember
you don't remember it,
the pizza shaped ridings. That was the big thing, and it was a rezoning of ridings,
right,
redistricting as they call it in the United States. I don't know what to call it here.
Same,
changing the boundaries of each of ridings, which they do every 10 years or so.
Yeah.
And in Saskatchewan, I remember the ridings in Regina and Saskatoon. The ridings were shaped like pizza slices.
Spoken wheel is what we called the method, where it was a piece of the urban and a piece of the rural was together. So it looked like a pizza slice. Or
and that gave your party an advantage.
It gave us an advantage in that you would have the urban area that there could be concern that would be more progressive voters, so Liberal or NDP. But if you overwhelm them with rural, the Conservatives would win. So that was the method that Saskatchewan had run their elections for many years. People thought that was the right way to do it.
Right.
In redistribution in 2013, the committee decided to change that. Mm-hmm. Funny enough, since they've changed that, the Conservative Party has never lost a seat in Saskatchewan.
Well, there might be other reasons. Might be other reasons for that.
Sure, but two elections in a row, we've swept the province. Obviously, having Andrew Scheer as leader
from
there certainly helped. But no, that
and it was really just Ralph Goodale.
That it was the one seat.
It was the one seat.
But still, like, there's always concern. There's a lot of tough fight. Yeah. You know, Kelly Block won by 1%, I think, in one election. Now she wins by.
Yeah. And those cities, Saskatoon in particular, tends to be more progressive, right?
Yes. So the committee changed it, and obviously the Conservative Party was not happy with this. So there was a decision to send a robocall, legal and ethical robocall, to the province, expressing our displeasure with that and to get, because this was still, the committee had recommended it wasn't final yet, there could still be changes to how this is done,
but the problem was the robocall was a push pull.
There was wires were crossed internally on what was going out,
and but by push pull I should say it's pretending to survey people's opinions by
and
robotic phone call, but in fact it's delivering a political message.
Yeah.
And I think the phrase I remember from that is that, you know, do you support Saskatchewan values? And it's basically suggesting that the redistricting of the ridings, which was being done by a relatively independent or arm's length body, was somehow a political maneuver to attack Saskatchewan values. And that's what it was, I think, that set people off about it.
Right. And well, I think the issue is there was an issue with the CRTC rules of who's behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what was missed in it. It, you know, whether it should be a poll or not, or how it was, how that was framed, it was about The issue was, the legal issue was that the name of the party wasn't included.
Right.
But at the same time, a message was supposed to go out. It wasn't supposed to be a poll, yeah, according to the people that made the decision to do this, to push it out. And wires got crossed. I was actually, it was a Friday afternoon. I'm getting my hair cut. I'm in, and I get a text from you saying, hey, you polling in Saskatchewan.
Oh, really? I got it. Okay, again, your memory is way better.
I say text, could be an email.
Yeah.
And I, so I go back to the person who I would know, hey, are we polling? Because we poll all the time.
Did you abandon the haircut at that
we're
point?
We're political
Did you
party.
Walk out of the, get, slough off the
No, this
the
was an
apron
easy, this was an easy, this isn't an issue for me. Okay. Are we polling in Saskatchewan? Well, yeah. I'm going to find out. Easy to send a note to people who, because again, we're a political party, we poll often. No, we're not doing any polling in Saskatchewan, is what right. I get back. So I tell you,
right,
we're polling in Saskatchewan. We're, sorry, we're not polling.
Yeah.
It's not happening.
Right. And I wrote a story saying...
We were.
saying you were, but you denied it.
Right.
Right. And then you learn later that, in fact, you had been.
Then we were. Then, yes. And it was a major blow. I offered to resign.
Did you really?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know
I lied to a reporter. Not meant to, but...
I don't think we ever wrote that you lied. I mean, I think...
No.
I think,
but
I
gave you incorrect information, and I didn't dig hard enough myself to find it. I think I could have actually pieced it together. I think, again, wires were crossed internally on this. It wasn't supposed to go out this way, and the people who made the decision to... They want to send a message out. That didn't internally go through the right channels, and I should have caught that.
Right.
So I... but again, I offered to resign, and I was told this is not your fault. So.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's the way we interpreted it as, you know, a mistake, an internal miscommunication. I think you were up front with that. You said that was the case.
Yeah.
I think CBC was harder on you than we were, but anyway.
Tends to be the case. Though I'm on TV with them every week now, so that's
anyway,
fine.
It's all water. Like I say, I've sort of forgotten it all. That's funny, you do hundreds of these stories over the years, and you just kind of forget. You know, that when you're actually engaged in doing the reporting, and I'm sure it's the same engagement for you on the other side of it, trying to do the communications, it becomes kind of like a battle and you really get wrapped up in it. But then once it's over.
No, 100%.
It's over.
Robocalls. So In-N-Out scandal was, even though I think that was, you know, obviously the more serious thing where we paid a fine was more serious, but not as difficult as robocalls where I was chasing ghosts all the time, getting all of these calls from all of these writings and all of these papers. And it was very difficult.
I'm interested that you think that the robocalls had an effect on the outcome of the 2015 election.
Yeah,
I tend to think that the Duffy affair had
for sure
more of an impact.
Not saying that didn't.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's kind of cumulative. I guess like it becomes part of this. I hate the word narrative, but it does become
a part of the story that something's not right here. Because like the robocalls thing was a lot of. People, our own people were wondering, did we do this?
Yeah.
Is there some national plan to steal elections that we were doing, which I can guarantee you was not happening?
Yeah.
Like, we're just the people that are particularly in 2011, very ethical people in charge of the party and the campaigns who just wouldn't push those boundaries.
And that was
also,
Jenny,
it wouldn't work.
Jenny Byrne running that election campaign
for the
first time, right?
She was national campaign manager in 2011.
Right.
And Guy Journeau was national campaign
manager. It would have been Doug Finley previously.
Right.
Late Doug Finley.
Right.
Yeah.
And I can, working closely with Guy and Jenny, there's no way in hell they would have tolerated any kind of shenanigans like this.
Right.
Particularly where it doesn't, to your point you mentioned earlier, it wouldn't work. It's nonsense.
And if you're going
to
do it, why would you do it in Guelph, in which was a strong liberal seat?
I think that was a target seat we wanted to pick up early on, but we knew halfway during the campaign that wasn't one we were going to get. It's those, and I often tell people this when I talk to interns and stuff in the party, don't fight this last campaign like it's your last. Work hard. But don't do stupid things. Don't do stuff that's going to come back to haunt you in future things.
I mean, I always wondered to what extent that the party essentially getting away with In-N-Out contributed to robocalls in the sense that, here's the young guys working on the Guelph conservative campaign. You know, they're either in school or fresh out of school. They're ambitious. They really believe in what they're doing. And they see the leadership of the party feuding with Elections Canada, being effectively contemptuous of some of the existing election laws on spending caps, at least. And I wonder if they think that emboldens them and say, you know what? Screw them. We're going to do this little trick here. I don't know. I mean,
well, hopefully if that's the case, And I don't know if it is, but if it is, hopefully people will at least have learned from that instant. You and Mar have made a great career out of the robocalls thing. Like there was, so Mar's written a number of fiction books.
Yeah.
And I often tell him he's my favorite, one of my favorite fiction writers, and my favorite thing he's written is robocalls.
So I'm sure he likes that line. And he's a fellow Nova Scotian too. There's something about Nova Scotia that it's great for generating political operatives and journalists alike. And we talk about how they're, you know, those two roles are often aligned.
Well, I first met Mar when I first moved to Ottawa. My first job was working on Harper's leadership campaign, doing communications for Atlantic Canada during the leadership campaign. And he had just arrived on the Hill as the bureau chief for the Chronicle Herald, the Nova Scotia paper.
Right.
So we developed a really natural relationship.
You probably knew everybody from back home too, right?
We knew all the players. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You're from Cape Breton. He's from Truro.
I'm from Antigonish.
Oh, Antigonish. Okay.
Born in Cape Breton, but raised in Antigonish. He's a Truro boy.
Right. Yeah. So, but you know, everybody in Nova Scotia seems to know each other at least. That's there's a lot of Nova Scotians in Ottawa. I don't know what the deal is with that. Like, you can't swing a cat without somebody telling you a story about Glace Bay or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Right?
Nova Scotians like to run the countries, I guess.
I guess.
That's how it is. So, Glenn, the way you've covered campaigns, the investigative journalism you've done, and the way it's perceived by the public, you know, you've worked in the biggest newspaper chain in the country, and you've worked in the biggest news broadcast network. How is media perceived now? How are stories being told, and how's it changing in future elections? Like I'm seeing in social media, I think the biggest news outlet in the country right now is Pierre Poilievre. It's him pushing his message out directly to Canadians. That's what Harper tried to do, and we did do to some degree back in his time, where we would skip over the press gallery and go to the regional newspapers and broadcast outlets and go right to the regions. And Poilievre has taken that now that we have social media in with him, where Harper didn't have at this level.
Right.
How do you feel this is being, how this is going to go with all the fragmentation?
It's worrisome, I think. I think it's worrisome for the what we can call legacy media or conventional media, MSM, if you want. They're in trouble because, first of all, people are increasingly getting their news from different sources. They're getting it from Twitter, from Facebook, and there's huge problems with that because this information is quite often not verified, and it kind of becomes an echo chamber that you go to look for news that's going to confirm your own opinions. Whereas it used to be, if you only got your news from the Globe and Mail or from Post Media, you would be challenged a lot. You'd have to kind of consider different points of view, and I think that's really good for democracy. If you're not doing that, you're only going to, and if you're only getting your news from Pierre Poilievre's Twitter channel, you're going to have a really distorted perspective that isn't, I think, ultimately not healthy for democracy, not to be too, you know, judgmental about it. But I'm really curious. I wanted to ask you about this when you're talking about campaigns. What do you think the next conservative campaign is going to be like, especially on journalistic access? I was talking about how we go on the planes and it's kind of a hostage taking. But I'm curious, do you think Poilievre is even going to allow reporters on his campaign plane whenever that election is?
I don't even know, does he have a campaign plane? Like, is it the big monstrosity that we usually have that costs a huge chunk?
Sure. Yeah.
We're only allowed to spend so much money, as you and I have discussed.
And the leader's campaign takes like at least half of it, right?
Yeah, it's a huge chunk, the tour and just the rental of a massive plane. If you shrink that down, if he gets a small plane that he can jump around with his core staff, and what does he need for a core staff? A personal assistant, a videographer, like a few digital people.
Yeah.
He could shrink that down. And we saw in Ontario, Doug Ford, just a few years ago, had no media on his tour.
Right.
And he won. And that's one third of the country, right? Ontario. And it worked for him.
Right.
So I would not be surprised if they go that route where media is not, you're not covering the day to day. So if you have issue with Aaron O'Toole having you in the studio and not getting to see the country.
This is going to be worse.
This is going to be, could
yeah,
be.
Yeah. And it's going to put, you know, the news outlets at a really difficult decision point, because how do you cover a campaign that you're not allowed to cover? They're not inviting you.
Well, you can go. You just got to find out where he's going and get there first.
Well, if they tell you where he's going, you can travel on independently.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, at a certain point, I think news outlets might say, okay, well, we can't tell you anything about what Pierre Poilievre was doing today because he didn't tell us.
Right. But if that's the story, he's out there still telling his story to his following through his network. So maybe this works very well for him, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think we're probably heading to that point that he's decided he doesn't need conventional media to reach his followers. I mean, whether that will hold up during an election campaign? Like, will they lose faith halfway through it? I don't know.
Everything changes once that writ drops. There's a feeling in the air, right?
Everybody's got a plan until you get punched in the face, right? Mike Tyson said, right,
right, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So that's that's how that goes. So, it'll be very interesting as an observer now, as someone stepping back from campaigns like I am, to watch how this unfolds.
Yeah.
But looking at the fragmentation, you know, someone gave me the stat recently, Joe Rogan's podcast, we see it everywhere, right. Everyone listens to it. And as a campaigner myself, if I was to advertise and try to find out exactly where it goes, like with that, only 5% of the market he has. A guy who's dominating.
Yeah.
Now that 5% is actually huge in today's numbers, right?
Right.
So I don't know how you even
how you advertise.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it, yeah, how you do that outreach. I mean, you know, ideally, I just wish we could get back to the days where campaigning was like people go down to the local church and hear the candidate, or go to the, like you say, the Kiwanis Club or whatever, and make their judgments based, and also, I mean, vote for their candidate in their riding.
No one ever does that.
I do that.
No, you.
I've
don't.
Always done that.
You vote for the local candidate.
No,
really,
absolutely, okay. Absolutely.
You're that weird tiny percentage of Canadians that do, right? Because everyone votes for leader first, party second, local candidate distant third.
Yeah, I always vote for the local candidate. I don't want to have somebody.
It's the only way Sean Fraser beat me, right?
If you had been my candidate, Fred, I would have strongly considered voting for you.
Based on the heat we had during that time when I ran, I don't think that's true. But look, thanks so much for having this chat.
Hey, really fun talk. We should do it again. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Is there anything else? So you're freelance writing right now. You're doing lots of projects.
I'm freelancing. I got a lot of different clients, including iPolitics, that I write for. Try and file weekly, and sometimes don't always do that, but because I'm busy. And I'm enjoying it. I'm essentially gone back to print, although I'm doing a little bit of podcasting. So I like kind of going back to that kind of journalism. And because I don't have a boss anymore, I can pretty much chase whatever I want to do. Right. Self-assigned.
You can really dig into things.
Yeah.
Too, then, right?
But I work all the time. That's the other thing. You know, talking about Trudeau, not taking days off. I never take days off.
Right.
Like I literally work 7 days a week because if you're freelancing, you have to. Like you can't slack off. Otherwise, you just don't get paid.
Right. You eat what you kill.
Yeah. Eat what you kill.
All right. Well, I think I survived that. I went up against one of the biggest antagonists of my career, someone who has cost me many sleepless nights. And it was a fun chat. Thank you so much for listening. I really hope you subscribe, send it to your friends. But also, I want feedback. I'd love to get more emails. I'm getting lots of wonderful ideas from folks for future episodes. Send me an email at onbackground@ipolitics.ca. Next week, excited to talk about majority or bust for the Conservatives. And I'm going to have my good friend Tasha Michaud joining me. We'll see you next time when we go on Background.